Hello and welcome to today's Continued Conversation, the podcast of the International Academy for Leadership, also known by its German acronym IAF. Today we continue a conversation we began in our seminar on the future of liberalism, in which we have looked at the current state of liberalism and its proponents around the world. We have examined shortcomings and possible blind spots of liberals that might have led to what we observe in a growing number of countries, and that is often referred to as an anti-liberal backlash. And of course, we also explored what liberals could or should do to defend liberal values in our societies, as well as the achievements liberal democracies have produced over a number of decades. I'm Bettina Solinger, I'm the head of the IAF, and as always, Sven Gers, my team partner for this podcast, joins in as well. Welcome, Sven. How are you today? And who is our guest with whom we are thrilled to continue our conversation?
Well, thanks, Bettina. I'm very well, and I'm very much looking forward to our conversation with Alex today. Alex has written a fabulous book on liberalism as a way of life that very much inspired me over the last couple of months, and I'm very excited to have this conversation on a more comprehensive liberalism. And as per usual, I won't introduce Alex further. I will leave this pleasure to him. So Alex, how would you introduce yourself to our listeners?
I would first say hello to Bettina and Sven, and thank you so much for having me. I'm professor of politics and philosophy at the University of Sydney. If you have an ear for accent, I'm from Canada, but I live now in Sydney, Australia. And what I teach is I teach the history of political thought and some key ideas like liberalism and human rights. And for the past 10 years or so, my research has really been on the idea that what we typically think of as political stuff, things like human rights or liberalism or those kinds of ideologies, are in fact full of, let's say, spiritual meaning, and that people can find ideas and inspirations for how to live a good life through them. So that's what I've been trying to write out. And the reason I take it you've had me on your podcast is to talk about my new book, which is Liberalism as a Way of Life, published just this year with Princeton University Press.
And let's dig right into your book right from the start. As I said before, it inspired me very much to think about a more comprehensive set of liberal values than the usual, like traditional conversations that we have in political philosophy. And maybe just as a side note, on one of our last podcasts with Steve Davies, your book was recommended as one of those books that liberals should pick up and maybe haven't heard yet enough about it.
So thank you.
What was the motivation to write a book that is, I would say, quintessential against liberal orthodoxy? So liberal orthodoxy is to think about liberalism as kind of a political doctrine, like how to structure the institutions that govern our social and political life. Now, you come around with an idea that, well, liberalism runs much deeper than that. It could be potentially a way of life. And that seems very puzzling to, I would say, political philosophers and political theorists such as myself. So what was the motivation for your book?
So the big motivation starts with a really very simple, very fundamental question. And it's the question I open the book with, which is I ask my readers, where do you, dear reader, you Bettina, you Sven, where do you get your values from? And the question is very simple, it's very personal, it's very direct, but I think it's very challenging for a lot of people to answer nowadays. So if you're religious, that question is super easy. You just point to your church, your faith, your Bible, your doctrine, and that question answers itself. I get my moral framework from, say, Christianity. Great, no problem. But as we know, especially in Western societies, and despite being on the end of the earth, I count myself as one of them in Australia, but Germany, the USA, England, and the rest, the largest group of people on the rise right now in terms of religion are those who don't profess a religion. It's the people who are seculars. That's the category that's growing more and more. And if you ask a typical secular person where they get their values from, I think they're going to be really, really stumped. They're going to typically, and I've asked a lot of people, I've pestered a lot of my friends, I ask them this question, and their first impulse is to say something very personal, like my experience, my friends, my family. That's where I get my moral framework from, my values, my sensibility. And all that's perfectly true. And I don't want to discount any of that. Of course, that's massively important. But there are other bigger, broader frameworks that we are enculturated in and that we learn what is right from wrong, what is good from bad, what is normal from abnormal. And what I want to suggest is that today, the thing that so many people who aren't religious should be pointing to, that name they should affix to who they are at a very deep level, is liberalism. And I think that that's something that liberals especially don't recognize enough about their ideology, that it's not, I don't think, just a political thing anymore. It goes right down into who we are and what we think of as important, outrageous, normal, funny, worthwhile, God help us, sexy. All of that stuff starts to be informed in a very deep way, I think, by this ideology that is mainstream now called liberalism.
But then seems somewhat counterintuitive, right? If I look around in the world, if I'm on Twitter, if I look at the news, if I look at recent election results, if I look at how my fellow citizens are behaving, I have a hard time to say, well, they are all liberals, you know, like in the same way that I conceive myself as a liberal, you know? So like, what am I getting wrong here? Am I just surrounded by the wrong bubbles, or what's going wrong?
Your bubbles are fine, Sven, don't panic. No. Listen, we have to be careful as to what we're talking about. So some people are what I call liberal all the way down, in the sense that their liberal commitments run very deep. Some people are mishmashes, are combinations of liberalism plus something else. So most Christians in the Western world are Christian plus liberal, like their faith has been smooth or influenced in important ways by Christianity. Now, what I think you're pointing to, on the other hand, is anti-liberals, post-liberals, people who reject this whole thing. And we're just 2 weeks after the American election, and I was sure I would never sell another book again or be invited on another podcast. So I get exactly what you're saying. My answer to that is complicated, and I'd like to dig into it with you. But first of all, I think it's important to distinguish who is still a liberal but having a disagreement with you about what they think our society should look like, and who is genuinely not a liberal anymore. And so I think that you have plenty of right-wingers that are still broadly recognizably in the liberal tent. They just have a different vision for how politics, economics, should play out. So a libertarian and a social democrat, they're both broadly sense, in some important sense, liberal, but they're just running in completely different directions. But on the other hand, you have people who are post-liberal. And for me, the criteria for what is in the liberal camp and what's outside the liberal camp, I think it's one big value, if I could put it that way, it's fairness and the idea that our society should be built for all of its members. If you think that, I think you are liberal in a core respect. But if you think that your country shouldn't, in fact, be built for all of its members, and there are some first-class citizens and second-class citizens, then that for me becomes a post-liberal sort of position. And at this point, I'm not criticizing, I'm just describing what would be liberal and what would be post-liberal. But there's plenty of debates to be had within both categories.
How would you define liberalism? What is your concept? How would you describe liberalism?
Good question. So it's a very, very difficult question. So the old joke is bring five liberals in a room and get 10 definitions. So we have to be very clear, because it depends. First of all, it depends on history, like so many different conceptions of liberalism through time. Fine. But it also depends incredibly on geography and where you find yourself. So in Australia, it's kind of a center right thing. In France, it means like a hardcore right individualist. In the US, it means pretty lefty kind of person. So we have to be clear about our definitions. So what I would say is that liberalism, I'll give you the long answer, but I'll come to a point. Liberalism is an ideology that starts in the 19th century. That's when people started calling themselves liberal in the political sense that we would understand it today. And it was really an ideology back then that centered around two core values. And those values were how to be a free person and how to live in a free country, but also how to live in how to be a generous person and how to live in a generous country. So the word in English, liberal, combines both of those senses, both meaning free, but also generous. So a liberal person is someone with an open mind, let's say, and it had that kind of sensibility. And so in the 19th century, that's what united liberals of all different stripes. And as we move into the 20th century, what I want to say is that liberalism is a society that conceives itself, as I just suggested, as a fair system of cooperation from one generation to the next. So that is my definition. And a liberal country would be one that tries to make that real through its law, through its economy, through its social policy. That's where I would stop with my definition.
Like, let me just jump right in there. I think it sounds a lot like a Rawlsian approach. to liberalism, right? But much more on the moralistic side than just mere political institutions. I think in the book you at one point talk about that liberalism is kind of the water that surrounds us, and that we are often not aware that our values have changed towards our conceptions that are very like omnipresent of, like, for example, fairness and tolerance, which have been like core political claims and core political goals of the liberal movement. But nowadays they seem to be so much ingrained in our society. So, like, how can you, or can you elaborate a little bit more on a more comprehensive set of liberalism? Because it goes further than just a mere political institutions. It's not the way that you describe liberalism is like, oh, it needs to be fair by the institutions that are set out. But I think there is a moral sentiment that comes in here. Do I capture that correctly?
You capture that perfectly. So I was giving you the, and trying to give, I was overcorrecting. So rather than give you a fuzzy, unclear definition of liberalism like every liberal does, I tried to be really specific and give you a one-worder, which was fairness. But you're right to call me up on it, because the whole spirit of my book is to try to suggest how much it has become and how much it has started to inform who we are. So take it from the top with your question. My book is indeed inspired by the philosopher you mentioned, who is John Rawls. And he was the most important political philosopher of the 20th century. And he designed a liberal political theory based on the idea of fairness. But what's really important for Rawls is that he didn't start from first moral principles exactly, or he didn't just start by saying, I am a great philosopher and I will tell you what liberalism means. Instead, what Rawls does is he starts looking around his own culture. He looks at its political constitution, at its political speeches, at its judgments given by high courts. And he's like, he collects all this evidence. And so, like, imagine him at his desk and he has all of these different documents all around. And he starts to kind of sift through them. He's like, okay, what is at the heart of all these documents? Like, we really want to get to the bottom, to the bedrock of this thing. What is it? And he comes to this formulation, which I've suggested, which is that society is a fair system of cooperation from one generation to the next. And he thinks that that's going to click or with his readers, and that they're immediately going to recognize what he's saying because they too have been raised or socialized within those institutions. So it won't be like a giant revelation. They won't be like, oh, wow, of course. They'll be like, yeah, totally. I recognize that because it's all around me. So that's what liberals think that liberalism is. Now, what I want to say is that those ideas of fairness, but also a broader kind of set of them, of adjacent concepts, let's call them, of a support for personal freedom, like you mentioned, tolerance, the notion of reciprocity. I think, and I can talk more about this, also a certain notion of irony and play. I think all of those ideas have started to migrate much, much further than just political stuff that Rawls was kind of collating around his desk, and have migrated into, well, background culture in general, such that I think most people today acquire their liberalism not through civics lessons in high school or in university, but rather by switching on Netflix, by watching any of the commonplace entertainments, by learning the human resources codes of their workplace, going on dating apps that'll let you swipe and pick and choose your partner. All of that stuff, all of those practices are just imbued with liberal sensibilities. And I think that that's why it's the water that we swim in. And here I'll just note a fascinating component of the argument is that liberals, I think, are pretty bad at recognizing the scope of liberalism. They're like, yeah, it's a political thing. It's about rights. Fine. But you know who I think is excellent and indeed accurate about identifying the scope of liberalism? And that is conservatives, in particular, right-wing conservative critics. Why are they so good at it? Because they're threatened by it. And you tend to notice stuff that you're threatened by. So they look at liberalism not as laws and judges. They look at it as this, like, if you know the horror movie The Blob, like this monster that just grows and grows and grows and absorbs everything in its path, such that how we raise our kids, how we understand our husbands and wives, how we conduct ourselves at work and in friendship, all of that stuff starts to take on liberal qualities. And for them, that's terrifying. So I don't agree with them that it's bad or that we should avoid this stuff, but I'm saying they're very accurate as to perceiving how omnipresent liberalism has become today.
Well, let's unpack that. There's a lot in there. First of all, I might have the intuitive backlash that sounds awfully conservative to me, that liberalism is just a status quo. And maybe that was always my kind of quarrel with John Rawls, like, who is very much like justifying the status quo. If I had to summarize John Rawls to a certain degree, he was really, his project, as you described, is like looking around in the world, especially, like, I would say, not even domestically, but also on the international realm, and then basically justifying what we have. like giving kind of a post hoc rationalization of the institutions that we already have in place and the values that we have in place. And so liberals have always perceived themselves as progressive and avant-garde. And now you describe something counterintuitive, like, oh, liberalism is actually the water we swim in. It's the status quo. And so you make a whole movement like the liberals into something that seems to justify where we are. How would you respond to that? Are we well, not conservatives?
No, I live. I'm okay to hang out with them, but I'm not one of them. Let me put it this way. I think, on the one hand, I think you're quite right. On the one hand, I think you're quite wrong. So let me start with the right. I do think
that's what usually people say about me.
But... yeah, that's good. That's right. Like I've always known you. The idea is that you're right. It is status quo, and that Rawls is sort of reading off the writing that's on the walls of his own society and of our liberal societies. Like, look at what it already professes. But then, so that's on the one hand, yes, status quo. But then what Rawls does, he says, well, look on the other hand at how our countries are and how catastrophically short they fall short of the ideals that they themselves set for themselves. So you have, on the one hand, liberal societies talking this amazing game about being free, fair, generous, all that stuff. And then you look at the actual inequalities on the ground, at the actual behavior of people, their desires, and it is a tremendous chasm between that. And I would say that any society that tries seriously to organize itself along Rawlsian lines, or just liberal lines in general, that would like put its money where its mouth is, would be radically transformative. So that's what I would say to that. But then I would actually go a step deeper, because Rawls, if we take Rawls as just kind of this political thinker, then he would identify a vast gap between the ideals that we profess as citizens and then the state of our country. So that would be one thing. Like our countries, Germany, Canada, Australia, whatever, fall way short of the ideals. But what I'm trying to say is that if liberalism has, in fact, gone into the bloodstream of our culture, and if, in fact, we profess liberal values at a very deep, very comprehensive levels, then it's not just our countries that are being hypocritical. It's ourselves being deeply hypocritical. We, in our everyday cultural movements and interactions, are deeply at odds with the kind of person we take ourselves to be. So it's a challenge to the status quo, not just at a macro country-like level or system-based level. It's also a challenge to the micro-psychology-based level. And that's why I think Rawls is, I call him this in my book, but I call him a great moralist, in the sense that he's able to put his finger on who we take ourselves to be and how we may not quite realize that. Being liberal, in other words, is a radically transformative project. If the idea is to be free and generous at the core of liberalism, and if you were to start living those ideals and not just pantomiming them, and I'm as guilty as anyone, sorry, I'm not blaming other people. This is an inward-facing book. It would not just change Australia, it would change me.
Well, so if liberalism is now the mainstream, so to speak, the water in the mainstream, and with that word, of course, already rings a bell after all the campaigning in the last months. Yeah. Where do you think the conservatives come from? I mean, right wing, who obviously are very good in expressing that some people have been left out, that they have been excluded, that mainstream society culture is not catering to them, that they don't feel part of that, and that they want to have their country back. That's a claim that populists and right populists use everywhere where they are getting strength. So where does this come from? And where did we liberals forgot that?
Wrong. That's a great question. I mean, it would solve the world if someone could solve it. I can just point to a few indications. But I think liberalism has lost its way in important respects. And I think that's important. So we can talk a little bit more about the history. But like I said, in the 19th century, being liberal and being a liberal country meant being not just a free country, but a generous one. And through a whole series of developments in political philosophy, but also politics more broadly, liberals kind of forgot the generous part. They forgot the progressivism. They forgot the equality bit. And they really just started stressing half the formula. So when you get electoral rage going on right now and widespread rejection of liberal democracy, in a sense, that's understandable. That's people rightly facing up to liberalism and say, what the hell, you promised us this and look at what we have. And so that would be a liberal critique of liberal societies in the sense of indicting its own ideals, say, of fairness, not taking a look, like eggs cost twice what they do now. Education is skyrocketing. There's lines around the block to look at a crappy two-bedroom apartment in a bad neighborhood. Like, what the hell? All of this is enraging. And so if you want our societies to be more fair, I think that's an utterly accurate and appropriate and justified criticism. But I think it's a liberal criticism that you would be making of liberalism. Now, on the other hand, you would have these post-liberals, and they too want society to be more fair, but I don't think they want society to be more fair exactly for all of its members. They want it to be more fair for a certain core membership that they nominate on a certain basis of what have you, background, sometimes awfully race, et cetera, et cetera. And that becomes a very different proposition for me. And so what I see when I look around the world today is I see one thing that's roaring back in country after country, mostly from, sometimes from the left, but mostly on the right. But it kind of, it crisscrosses these ideological divides, which is that I think more and more states are happy to be democratic, but they're not happy to be liberal anymore. And in particular, a lot of states are very ready and willing to use the power of the state to promote a certain conception of the good life that many, if not most of its adherents believe in. So you look, for example, this is not a liberal or democratic country, but China. China now talks all the times in terms of promoting a civilizational state and promoting a certain kind of subject. You look at India. India now is talking a huge game about trying to marry a certain conception of democracy and a certain conception of Hinduism in a kind of like theocracy light. You look at MAGA Americanism, Make America Great Again, and that is the restoration of a particular kind of person and value set, et cetera, et cetera. So more and more, this is the post-liberal stuff that I'm trying to highlight as distinct. Those are places that see the world as profoundly wrong and want to fix it, but their idea is to fix it for people like them.
Yeah, let me just dive into that one a little bit, because I'm really struggling with the analysis here on my side. So on the one hand side, I have always argued, and I think there I have been rather alone, that the emergence of populism is due to liberals' failure. So for example, I always said the liberals have failed to deliver on certain aspects or living up to the values and promises that they are making. I mean, politics, as Tocqueville already rightfully noted, is all about expectations. And then if you have certain expectations and if you claim from the moral high ground that, for example, everybody has a fair go is the core principle of our societies and we don't live up to that, then it's just natural that the backlash emerges. And that's, I think, what explains a lot of the populist backlash. On the other hand side, I also see the power of the post-liberals, the conservative thinkers who say, well, actually, liberal democracy has gotten away from something that is as existential and important as the good life or whatever it is, you know, the common good, as it is often referred to. And it also has some power and intellectual appeal. But on the other hand side, I'm just not convinced that enough people are detaching themselves from their core liberal commitments to really set up and stand behind a Patrick Deneen or Adrian Vermeule type of society. I think they are still niche, even though they have quite a lot of intellectual presence, but they are quite niche. And I think most of the Trump voters or voters generally are ready to adhere to their vision of society. So where do you fall in that camp? Do you see that this is also kind of mishmash of both phenomena? Or are you saying, okay, actually the backlash that we are seeing is mostly due to either side of that argument, either the post-liberals gaining track with a very strong argument for an existential need, or on the other side of the argument where we say, well, actually, it's due to the failure of liberalism itself?
Definitely, I think both answers are totally correct. And I won't assign ratios, but I would say 60% of the dissatisfaction is in the first camp, that liberalism is simply not delivering. And then, I don't know, 30%, something like that, has a much more radical vision to move beyond it. And these are the kind of the spokespeople of Deneen and Vermeule's, leading Catholic American political philosophers and jurists that want to try to bring about a new kind of vision of the collective good as actualized through law and through policy in the United States in particular. So I would agree with all that. I just think that the loudest and most articulate and systematic spokespeople of the dissatisfaction with liberalism on the right are the post-liberals. The people who are identifying the kind of internal critique that you're making are just the Democrats who, it's like the Bernie Sanders crowd, for example. Those people are still committed to liberalism, but you just tend to find them more on the left.
Although I have never been equated with Bernie Sanders, I will take that argument to a certain degree. I've always warned that. Yeah, I'm not fully sure whether like that is a compliment, but after all, I might say that liberalism has lost its way. And I want to dig, before we go into maybe your propositions to a certain degree, I want to dig one more time into why liberalism lost its way in its intellectual history. So here are some of my thoughts, and maybe you contextualize them and tell me what you think about it. On the one hand side, I think intellectually, liberalism has become rather stale. Over the last two or three decades, liberalism didn't really develop further. We are still doing in political philosophy a lot of Rawlsology, you know, like we just like having dissertation after dissertation on the topic of John Rawls. And I have great appreciation for John Rawls, as you might also have. But on the other side, I have a hard time finding the top intellectuals in the liberal realm that put forward a vision of liberalism, how it should be in the 21st century. Like I asked recently the question in one of my seminars, like who would be the leading thinkers of the height and of like an Isaiah Berlin, of a Friedrich August von Hayek, of even Milton Friedman, like the public intellectuals of liberalism, and they don't seem to be there. So that's kind of my first assessment. And the second is we had certain developments in the intellectual history of liberalism that maybe have contributed to that losing way of being an intellectual adventure. So for example, in the post-World War II era, we had a strong pushback against the state itself. And so one of the core tenets of liberal theory has become kind of a pushback of the state and focusing on individual rights and the rule of law and the institutions that would prevent us from tyranny, instead of like making it a positive project to say, actually, that's how a liberal open society looks like, very much in the vein of Karl Popper here. So do you share this analysis, or what are your thoughts on the intellectual development of political philosophy, liberal political theory in the last couple of decades?
I agree. I agree with what you say. And I find the kind of flatness absolutely correct. And I mean, that's in a sense the gift of liberalism having won, in a sense, after 1989 and gone to a unipolar world. You have Francis Fukuyama basically saying we in 1989, we got it right. And he said that was depressing and it would be boring and stagnant. But he did think that we had arrived at a kind of equation. And if that's the truth, then your claim that political theory has become essentially decadent makes a lot of sense. We're just playing out kind of a set of ideas that we had, making like kind of rearranging some stuff, and that would be good enough. But liberalism has always been at its best when it got a kick in the ass from some enemy that made it do something other, think its challenge. And so that's the way the history of liberalism has really evolved. And what I mark out in the 20th century are three big moments of liberal evolution that have sort of landed us into this state. So the first big one that had its great thinkers were, I'm going to build up to the, I think we're in the fourth wave now, but the first great wave of liberal transformation in the 20th century was precisely the von Mises and the Milton Friedmans that you discussed. I don't share their view, but what they did is they looked around their world and were very apprehensive about a large socialistic government and the spread of communism and the progressive aspects of liberalism, and they feared for individual freedom and individual initiative. And so what they did is they looked backwards and basically cherry-picked aspects of a 19th century liberal tradition that really clicked with what they wanted to see, and they called it classical liberalism. They invented it backwards, and they say liberalism should be about market freedoms and a minimal watchman kind of state, and that would be that. So I don't like that, but that's a real intellectual renewal of what liberalism was meant to be, based on a moral project, namely the idea of fairness and of individual freedom. That should be animated. So that's phase one. Phase two, as I read it, was the Cold War liberals. And so here you have your Isaiah Berlins, for example, but many more. Leonard Trilling, Albert Camus, and Judith Schlar. I was about to mention Schlar. I'm going to come back to her, actually. She's so interesting. But they, I mean, they kind of looked at, they, so they were in the boom of Soviet Union, and they looked at a state that was trying to be communistic is in the name, but also perfectionist and trying to impose its sense of what a new kind of great human being would look like. And they said, fuck that. That's terrifying. What we need are barriers against that stuff. So Cold War liberalism reinvented itself as a shield against power. It wasn't so much about facilitating market interactions anymore. It was about protecting some breathing room for the individual to determine themselves by their own, on their own freedom and on their own terms. So great. Third, so that's paradigm number two. Paradigm number three is the Rawlsian one. And one of the, I mean, there's different ways in which to think that, but the one that we've been caught in for so long is that where people see liberalism as now is as providing a political philosophy and a political framework for pluralistic societies. So our world has become much more global, huge migration flows, different points of view tolerated. And what we need to do is create countries in that can gain the robust support of all different kinds of people, Christian, Muslim, Jewish, atheist, whatever. They all have to live together, not just not kill each other, but robustly support a national framework. So that's the next great moment of liberalism. And that's, I think, where we sort of stagnated for the last 30, 40 years, that liberal states should be for everyone, should be inclusive. And none of that. So I'm doing kind of my sarcastic voice. I don't mean to say that the vision is in any sense unworthy. I just think that, like you, Sven, I think it has not had much growth or yet. And so maybe liberalism, like any doctrine, needs its opponent to come into itself. And now we certainly have that around the world today. So I see some interesting thinkers right now of liberalism. I would think one of them is Samuel Moyn, working at Yale. I think he's very good internal critic of liberalism, but we'll see how they emerge.
Well,
push back? Did you?
No, I fully share your assessment. Before I hand over to Bettina, I fully share your assessment, and I think you give us a nice framework on how to see the transitions happening. I have my great appreciation for a lot of the thinkers that you mentioned beforehand, but I see that we have been captured in these paradigms. So I take the good things out of Hayek or the good things out of Isaiah Berlin, but I also recognize that we need to combine them with the new challenges and the contemporary issues that are at stake. And as I said, like, liberalism developed not only as a political doctrine, but also as a social doctrine. Like, people's attitudes have changed. And the worries that we might have had in the post-World War II era are maybe different right now. Steve Davies always talks about a great political realignment. The politics of the 1960s or 1970s are not the politics that we find ourselves in today. Now, for example, the economic question is not something that is up for grabs. We are not in a systematic rivalry between socialism and capitalism anymore. To a certain degree, even in many societies, we now have left-wing thinkers who appreciate certain parts of the market economy. So I think there we have much more congruence and much more liberal achievement than we had in the past. And the rivalry between capitalism and socialism is maybe not the paradigmatic clash that we have had in the past. Now it is between the open and the closed societies, very much between the liberals and the post-liberals. And I would hand over now to Bettina to transition a little bit over to what it actually means to be a good liberal.
Mm. That's exactly the question. So the diagnosis now is we haven't lived up to our liberal ideals and ideas. We have not, we might have turned a blind eye to what is going on in society. So at the end of the day, I mean, just the book is named Liberalism as a Way of Life. What makes a good liberal then? And what is a good liberal life?
Well, to condense 200 pages into 90 seconds of answer, let me give it a go. I'll take a step back and take a running start at the question. In particular, trying to say a word about who I'm trying to speak to and why. So the book, I should have said this earlier, but the book isn't written to convince people who are not liberal to be liberal. I'm not trying to get the Christian, I'm not trying to tell people to abandon their religion, but I'm not even trying to teach conservatives or post-liberals to be liberal. What I'm trying to speak to is for liberals to become more genuinely or authentically liberal. And one of the interlocutors for my book, an author I really love, it kind of makes a short appearance in it, but he's decisive for it, is Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard was the Danish theologian. He lived in the 19th century. He's one of the great social critics of his day. And when Kierkegaard looked around his 19th century cosmopolitan Copenhagen, he saw a society that on the surface looked really Christian. There was a church on every corner. Everyone's doing the things they need to do. But then he kind of like took a walk around the block once more, and he looked more carefully at these fellow Danes, his friends, and ultimately himself. And he's like, yeah, are we really Christian? Like, what do we really want? And really what most people want back then is what most people want now. They want social respectability, material comforts, some recognition, and like some, yeah, it's kind of like a roast on Sunday, a mistress on Saturday, I don't know, whatever. That idea would be the good life. And he's like, you aren't Christian. You're not authentically Christian. And so what he called, he coined this tremendous word to describe that world. He didn't call it a Christian world, but a world of Christendom, a world in which everyone is playing at their Christianity. It's just kind of like lightly doing it, maybe on a Sunday sometimes. Now, what I want to say is that we don't live in Christendom, but we do live in a word that I created just for this book, which is liberaldom. The idea that we live in these societies that talk the talk but don't walk the walk. And so like Kierkegaard wasn't trying to convince a Muslim to be Christian, I'm not trying to convince anyone but liberals to be liberal. And what I tried to do in the book is pose the question with as little bullshit as I can, because it's a very difficult personal question, as to why liberals would want to be authentically liberal. Now, what I should say right away is there's an easy answer to that question that I don't want to take. The easy answer is to say it's really nice to live in liberal societies. People treat each other fairly. They're stable. They're relatively prosperous, et cetera, et cetera. That's not my question. I don't want to ask why it's nice to live in a liberal society, because if that's the question, everyone can cheat. Everyone can just like free ride on the liberalism of others and basically pretend to be a good liberal and live in these nice, cozy societies, but just be kind of like a hypocrite themselves. And the advantages to living in a liberal society, I think, are obvious and plain, and I don't want to argue that. What I'm trying to find a resolution to or a convincing answer to is why it would be important for the ordinary person to be more liberal in their authentic desires in everyday life. And that question is really, really hard to answer, because there are obvious goods, really clear, manifest good things in life that come from cheating, that come from being illiberal. Like, it's really nice to pay less taxes. I like money. Like, who doesn't like money? Or my great liberal failing that I talk about in the book is I send my kid to private school. It's a very expensive school. She gets an excellent education, but I can't square that with my commitment as to being part of a society that's fair. I think private schools compound intergenerational inequality. So my question is then, if there is clear advantages to being unliberal, to being non-liberal for cheating, then what are the advantages of living a fully liberal life? And so what I tried to lay out in the book is all the advantages that are personal and psychological and experienced here and now that might come from being a liberal person. And in my most clickbait-like chapter, I have this chapter titled 17 Reasons to Be Liberal. And I just try to knock them out and say, this reason, this reason, this reason. And the reasons I give are some of this, like, it's like qualities of character that come from living up to your liberal values. Some of them things like becoming more impartial, being more autonomous. But I also talk about other stuff like being more fun, being more playful, being more graceful, being more tolerant, all these kinds of stuff that's just like intrinsically nice to be. And so that's the pitch I try to make to my reader. I try to sell them on why they should commit to the liberal ideals that they notionally profess to believe in.
But that doesn't sit well with me on all aspects, because like if I look at the intellectual history of liberalism, then one of the core projects has been, let's take Montesquieu or other thinkers, that it is, or like David Hume, for example, that it is to prevent tyranny. Like, we know that people are not ideal, and maybe we have to create a society where people don't share these values. We can still live in a liberal society even though those people don't share those values. A lot of the project that you just sketched sounds an awful lot like communism to me. Like, you know, we have to find the perfect liberal, then we can build an open society upon them. And here are some prescriptions how to become that perfect person. Here are some prescriptions that we have. You have 17 of them. And if you possess them, we can build a nice, happy, clappy liberal society around that. But before that, the project will not be completed. Now, on the other hand side, again, the David Humes and the Montesquieu's of the world said, well, we always have to work in a democracy with people who have these deeply illiberal sentiments. And by illiberal, I don't mean like bad sentiments, but it's just like our intuitions take over, our emotions take over. Like, for example, it's very hard to live up to the emotional character that you would need to be in an open society. Karl Popper is very honest about that, he calls it a strain of civilization to be detached sometimes, to sometimes think rationally through things. That's a very hard project to have. And so they designed institutions that would allow for individual liberty, even though people have the tribal instincts that we have as human beings. So are you just posing?
Am I a communist in liberal clothing? No.
Yeah. I just looked at how I phrased that the best. Are you just like a commie?
That's right. That's not my brand. No, listen, the communist gets the central committee and then the state to start insisting on these. So if I were a liberal communist in the way you say, I would get a little revolutionary cadre. I would go to the nation's capital here in Canberra. I would take it over and I would reform the education system so as to teach these communities liberal values day in, day out. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that at all. I do believe in the way that Montesquieu and Hume said is that we live in a society of devils. Well, that's Kant, but you get the point. And that we have to create these spaces that protect us from one another. And moreover, that we have to affirm pluralism because people live by their own light. So I'm not trying to tell other people how to live. And I'm certainly not what political philosophers would call a perfectionist in that I do not believe that the state should use its power, either its soft power or its hard power, to impose a certain way of life on other people. What I am trying to say, though, is I'm trying to give reasons for an individual liberal here and now to want to commit to their values that they profess. And the 17 things I mentioned, those aren't directives. Those are perks. Those are benefits. Those are rewards that come from trying to live up to the core commitments of a liberal faith, which I would name as a commitment to individual freedom, to fairness, and to reciprocity. This is the good stuff, the gravy, as we would say in the United States, of what can come from a liberal life. And it's not prescriptive. I'm just saying, hey, if you do this stuff, this other cool stuff might follow for you.
Well, so it's rather the invitation to develop oneself further.
That's a nice word, invitation. Thank you. That's the word I'm looking for.
I struggle a little bit with it because we all also know human nature. I think that's been a problem for liberals for a long time. We talk about tolerance, but also know how difficult it sometimes is to remain tolerant and to define the line where we can say, okay, this I won't tolerate anymore because I don't tolerate the intolerant. But where is this line? And that's something a society has to somehow negotiate and come up with norms. That's a really difficult thing to do.
I absolutely agree. Yeah, it's both a person. It's a collective society wide conversation. It's always so a personal deliberation. So I think you're completely correct.
And people also, you have been speaking about rewriting the liberalism. Behavior of others. That is something we also observe a lot in our societies. And I think that might be a reason why so many people are looking for regulations and laws. So to enshrine everything in the law, to have something tangible to hold people accountable to, because this a norm is hard to make people accountable to.
That's right.
I have lived 3 years in Argentina quite some time ago, and that was a society for me that looked very open, very people love books and have chats and debates and all that, and at the same time, it felt like there's a lot of distrust. If you had a negotiation with someone, it was always with a lawyer, nothing without a lawyer. There was a joke that Argentina is the country with the most psychiatrists and psychologists and therapists and lawyers. And everybody was looking for a way to hold others also accountable and to be able to trust in the result of a negotiation in between two persons, but also organizations and in society. And that led to some sort of emotional erosion or trust in society. Yeah. And I think trust is something that that we desperately need. And now when I look around Germany, when I look or hear stories from other countries, this trust issue is coming up really often. So,
no, I think, yeah, I think that's entirely correct. I mean, I think one of the most important books of the last 10 years has been the Ziblatt's, the Levitsky and Ziblatt's book, How Democracies Die. And their thesis, I mean, they don't put it this way, but it's what you're saying. It's when trust ends. And so they say that democracies die not through kind of formal constitutional changes or through the military storming the palace. It dies when people no longer agree to trust the same norms that we all behave by, start really insisting on the rules in a really legal kind of way. And then all the kind of like soft lubricant power that happens between us, all that stops and society just kind of comes grinding to a halt. And so I think that any society, liberal, democratic, or whatever, has to work on trust very deeply. Excuse me, what makes trust difficult, maybe particularly to achieve for liberals, is that liberalism is maybe uniquely a political ideology that's not based around a common conception of the good, whether that's a religious good, like a god, or a certain kind of excellent way to live. So if you don't have that, that's a major pillar of trust knocked out, because I can't count on you to hold the same ideals as me. That shared ideal really kind of facilitates a lot of social coordination. Liberal societies aren't good with that because we want tolerance, we want self-determination. So liberalism has to forge trust without a shared conception of what it means to live well and without a shared metaphysics. And that is an experiment that's playing out today all over the world, and who knows if it's run its course. But we didn't do so bad for a while. Like, honestly, it was, I think we kind of take lightly the civilizational achievements that we have. I mean, our world, I know it's easy to be pessimistic, but our world is this extraordinary achievement. That we have Wikipedia, that we have friendship between the sexes, that we have peaceful transfer of power. Like, holy shit, all of that stuff is magnificent. And all of it rests on the fragile edifice of trust, of give and take, and of people agreeing to continue this shared project of ours. And there's nothing stronger, but there's also nothing more fragile than that. I don't know what you think, Bettina.
Yeah, I think that's a fair observation. You have said earlier, your book doesn't speak to illiberals or anti-liberals. Still, they do fairly well in elections, I doubt that all the voters are know what they voted for. That's one thing, but that they are not anti-liberals. But maybe they are also people who feel that something is wrong in the society. Something I don't trust that, you know, my interests are somehow considered. But we need to also describe that a little bit more. So you also talked about we liberals haven't stood up for our values. We have not. We don't live by it. So are there any examples that you can describe it a little bit more? Where have we failed to show our liberal values in a way that it's also an invitation to join and to do the same?
Great question. I don't know. I mean, this is a collaborative conversation, so I'd love to hear from both of you on this. I just wrote my mandatory opinion piece on the U.S. election, and I'm trying to find a place to publish it because I have a very punchy title. The title is, "Hey Liberals, do you like this hegemony of ours? ? Then fucking act like it." That's my title. And I want to say that liberals need to do two things. That's the punchline of the piece. On the one hand, liberals need to take inequality more seriously. And second, we need to stop moralizing and grandstanding, because nothing turns rage and resentment on liberals like not delivering on fairness and then blaming or then talking down to them, calling them fascist, calling them whatever. And I think that if it in a sense, it's a tremendously complicated problem as to how to reinvent liberalism to gain popular support again. But in the end, it's a very simple question. Just get to the bread and butter basics of it. Take care of the cost of living, ensure equality of opportunity and stop making feel people crummy about themselves. So it's at once very difficult and it's at once very easy. But how would you react to that, both Sven and Bettina?
I mean, it just comes very timely, your opinion piece, because we just finished a seminar on the future of liberalism. And there we coined a term that I think is very handy in this conversation, that is deliberalism. In the end, it's not only about grandstanding. And I think taking the moral high ground is something that liberals have been very good at. And at times that was necessary in the advancement of a progressive, a more avant-garde sort of idea. But now, once we have realized that we are more status quo than we often recognize, I think it is the duty to now also deliver. And I think we haven't put enough effort into that particular aspect, what it means to have, for example, good liberal statecraft. So, of course, all of your philosophical reflections are important to really live up to liberal values in our day-to-day life. But there's also a political component to it. And that means that we have to now shape the institutions the way that they deliver for everybody so that this cognitive dissonance fades out. Because I think at the core of your concern and of my concern is cognitive dissonance. Like liberalism promises all those nice things, but it doesn't live up to that. And we feel like, okay, that has been a failure. And I mean, in a sense, in a kind of a proper way, we tried out this idea. It had a hypothesis, liberalism, namely that it will turn in our societies into a prosperous, free, diverse a social endeavor. But it didn't live up to that. And so we reject that paradigm, that hypothesis, and go with something else now.
Yeah, I agree with that. Listen, I think liberalism is very combustible for the reasons that you say. It teaches every single person that they matter and that they have, that they ought to have equality of opportunity. Exactly. And it anchors that in their self-conception. And so when they don't live up to it, you violate the core notion of what people have been led to believe by public statements from the cradle to their eventual grave. And that makes for a very volatile situation because you're leading people to believe one thing about themselves and delivering the opposite. So that's why I think liberalism can be truly a rage-generating machine.
Yeah, and maybe let me add to that one example that you make in the book. And for our listeners, I really recommend Alex's book also for the pop cultural kind of aspects of his analysis. And so you refer back to the TV show that I also enjoy very much, which is Parks and Recreation. And you mentioned Leslie Knope as a quintessential liberal. Now, I have my trouble with Leslie Knope because if I look at the TV show, then I find Leslie one of the most annoying characters. Right? Because she is occupying that moral high ground. And sometimes she has this kind of naive ambition in public affairs and public administration that my cynical liberal side might want to reject. I'm more on the side of Ron Swanson sometimes. And, you know, the Ron Swansons of the world are somehow capturing also some liberal sentiment. You know, so like, why is Leslie Knope a person that you would still put at the forefront of attention? And what do we make out of the Ron Swanson kind of figure? Because Ron Swanson also captures a lot of quintessential libertarian, classical liberal aspects or sentiments, right?
Okay, so I don't know how deep of a dive I can do into this TV show because you and I'm sure could get lost in this rabbit hole, no problem. So I'll keep it light. So the show that you're talking about is Parks and Recreation. It's a sitcom that ran about 10 years ago for maybe 6-7 seasons. And it's about this small town in America and about the small government department, and it follows their characters. And the hero of this is called Leslie Knope, and she is really just a can-do, progressive kind of liberal who thinks that government can make everything right and who really throws in with all her heart and soul into trying to make her town a better place. Now, the other character across from her is this guy. No one can see you, but you kind of look like Ron Swanson, so that helps. You got the right facial hair for it. So a very kind of outdoorsy, self-reliant kind of dude. And so it's the dynamic, one dynamic of the show is their long-standing kind of combat between a libertarian Ron and a much more kind of progressive social democrat, Leslie Knope. And so I really do champion and lionize, if you like, Leslie Knope as kind of a great liberal hero. I call it the greatest liberal that never lived. And some reviewers of my book have been pretty pissed off with that. What's his name?
Quite naturally.
Brandon Warmke. So a libertarian reviewed my book for Law and Liberty, and he really fastened on this idea of Leslie just being an utter disaster, not just of a political persona, but just as like a psychological one too. It's just like, this is bad. So I get it. I just tried to say that what she does is she really lives her liberalism all the way down. and how it manifests in her private life. So for me, she's liberals need more heroes, right? Like religions have their saints and martyrs. And if I want to make the claim that liberalism is just as interesting and deep as any religion, well, we too have to have our saints and martyrs. And they're sometimes a little bit more difficult to identify. But I tried to point one out with her. So yeah, I mean, and you're right. So I talked, this is going to sound name droppy, but through a weird connection, I had an email exchange with Michael Schur, who is the writer of that show. And he really did want to try to have Leslie and Ron model the two different positions, but also a kind of notion of civic friendship, that the two could come together in genuine friendship and maybe not political vision, but at least they could regard each other with mutual esteem. And now my kid is 16, excuse me, and we're rewatching that show now. And I'm in season three just now, and it feels dated. It feels nostalgic for an era of civic camaraderie that maybe is, at least we have to work to rebuild.
Talking about the heroes then, I might share Warmke's reservation about Leslie Knope being a liberal hero, but what other heroes come to your mind? And maybe more abstractly, what are some of the quintessential values then, like to name drop them, like what are some of the virtues that we would need to display to become those liberals that we aspire, at least in theory, to be? Because I think it's important to have the clarity on what are liberal virtues that we need to display in everyday life to not become a part of the liberal dom, so to speak.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Listen, I'll name three heroes, and then I'll start by saying I think that Listen, every conception of the good life, any religion is going to put like one, two, three big concepts at their heart. Christianity, it's going to be love. Confucianism, it's going to be something like harmony or piety or something like that. I think at the heart of liberalism should go two main commitments. One is to freedom and the other is to generosity. And so what I would want to look at is to people who exemplify those two qualities, both to live one's life by one's own kind of determination and also to be generous towards other, not just with their money, like not just paying higher taxes, that's part of it, but also with their kind of their attention, their charity, their patience, all of this stuff. So three heroes I would give. First is, I talk a lot about him in the book, is John Rawls himself. Every single person who ever was taught by him speaks of him as almost a saint, as this kind of genuinely patient, decent man who took everyone at face value. I went to the John Rawls archive a few years ago and I spent a month there. And every year, no matter how famous Rawls was, he would handwrite his lectures out page by page and take the time to revisit them. I was just stunned by that. And female philosophers in particular loved him because he was just so kind of like he wasn't caught up in the prejudices of his time, let's put it that way. So that's one hero I talk a lot about, and I talk about his biography, Rawls. Another one is a book written by one of the most extraordinary biographies I've ever read, which is by Tara Westover. So Tara Westover have you read this book, Educated?
Yes, Educated. It became a bestseller, I think, a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that was about maybe 5 years old now. So Westover was a young woman raised in Idaho by survivalist super Mormon parents. And bit by bit, she first learned about the Holocaust when she was 20. She learned how to read from the Book of Mormon. Like, it's just like an absolutely crazy upbringing. And slowly but surely, she learns how to gain a bit of distance from her parents, still appreciate and love them, but try to acquire a broader worldview and learn to become free and not to impose on others in the way she was imposed upon. So that was another. The third liberal hero, this is going to sound crazy, is the American public in the movie Borat. I talk about that in the book. So Borat is one of the, kind of the most crudest, crassest movies around. It's very funny, I think. And it's often seen as a kind of a send-up or a making fun, ridicule, a satire of America, in that Borat is this character that goes around provoking America in all these crazy ways. But when I watch that movie, I'm just struck by the utter tolerance and patience that normal American citizens have towards this character, Borat, who is played by Sacha Baron Cohen. He does all manners of outrageous things. And the American public is just like ready to, like, what civilization would Borat not just have been immediately killed or beaten or whatever? Like, very few. And yet Americans are just like, huh, yeah, interesting. They just kind of roll with the guy. And so that to me is liberalism at a very low key level, like basically just kind of public friendliness, getting along, moving on. And that's not nothing, especially when we're talking about things like Bettina was raising about trust, about not jumping down each other's throats and not trying to squeeze advantage out of other people that we don't know. And that, again, is it's a low key value, but maybe the most important one.
Before Bettina can jump in, Lloyd, just one comment here. I have been working on the topic of social trust for a while now. So for me, this is one of the most important liberal projects of our time, because I think what we overlooked in democracy is that democracy can undermine trust itself. And I think you talk about a great deal of that in your book yourself with Tocquevillian analysis of democracy, that it leads to a sort of undesirable individualism, materialism, and conformity. And I think all of these aspects have deeply understudied aspects or dimensions and impacts on social trust. So I really flag that to our listeners. Social trust is maybe one of the most important liberal projects of our time, looking at the trust levels and how they are plummeting. But I think we transition now over to one of the last parts of your book. So, Bettina.
Yeah, that's turning back to the more individual level on how to become more liberal. And in your book, you present spiritual exercises, so the how-to, the self-development, the invitation. Could you elaborate a bit on those exercises?
Sure, it'd be my pleasure. So one of the major, so the book is inspired by two authors, Rawls, which we've talked about a great deal, and then another author who is a French thinker. His name is Pierre Hadot, Hadot. If you haven't heard of him and you like philosophy, I rush out and read this guy. He is one of the most, he's one of the most generous, but also simple, but also learned authors I've read. He does reconstructions of what ancient philosophy means. And so his big career project was to look at philosophy, not just as an intellectual idea or not just as a system of concepts, but look at how philosophers, especially in the ancient world, but also in the modern one, saw philosophy as a way of life. That being a philosopher means not knowing a bunch of abstract stuff, but knowing, wanting to live a life according to wisdom and be truly embody that. And what he observes is that every philosophy, every religion has all kinds of very concrete practices to make this a reality. Like, it's all fine and well for your religion or your philosophy to have great ideas, but how do those become a reality? By practice. That's the idea. You have to train in them. And so he came up with this notion called spiritual exercises, which is day-to-day practices that individuals can take on whenever they want to try to recommit themselves to the philosophy or to the religion that they already profess. So Christianity, of course, has a million of spiritual exercises, all of which are famous. So you have prayer, you have confession, you have the Sabbath, you have saying thanks over dinner. All of that stuff is spiritual exercise. Now, what I try to suggest is that, look, liberalism, if it's going to be as great as a religion, it too needs spiritual exercises. We need conscious practices that we can adopt here and now to try to make ourselves more liberal. And I confess that this is just the beginning of this. I'm not going to do more of this work, but I'm just taking a tiny baby step in this direction. It's for other people, other authors, other traditions to try to come up with different and other and supplementary liberal exercises. But what I do in the book is I try to read Rawls in a certain kind of way, not just as a political philosopher, but as a moralist or as a psychologist. And I try to suggest that a lot of his most famous concepts, concepts that if you've heard of Rawls, you've heard of those concepts, that some of them can be read not just as political ideas, but as spiritual ones. So the most famous of which is this thing called the original position and the veil of ignorance. And it would be difficult to run through that right now, but the idea that Rawls is trying to get us to do is he's trying to get us, his readers, to try to think about justice outside of our prejudices, and in particular, outside of what he calls our positionality, namely that we wouldn't accept to try to design the major rules of our society based on what kind of advantages you can squeeze out of them given who you are. So I'm a white heterosexual guy. It would be kind of crazy for, it would be deeply wrong of me on my own moral beliefs to try to design a society that favors white heterosexual guys. Like, that's not the idea. But we do that all the time. We all the time make these little micro, it's not a microaggressions, these micro prejudices. I don't know what the what word is, but we always quietly tilt the tables in our own advantage whenever we can. And he's trying to get us not to do that. So he presents an exercise where we try to imagine that we don't know anything about ourselves, and we try to reflect on what kind of society we live in. And I suggest that that's not just a political thing, but it's also a spiritual thing. The two other ones I present, One is called, they all have really kind of, Rawls is a techno-philosopher, so they all have crazy names, but I think they're deeply human practices. So the other one is called reflective equilibrium. And the idea is there is to try to get a broader coherence in our beliefs and also in our beliefs and practices. So try to live a more integrated life. And he gives some steps as to how we might do that. And last, a chapter that I quite like, I think it's a little underdeveloped, but I think it works, is on public reason and basically how liberals should try to not just speak to other people who don't share their beliefs, but listen to them in the most generous kind of spirit possible to see them advancing reasons that we would recognize as good reasons. So there again, it's to recover this idea of generosity, but it's hermeneutic generosity, not just to jump down other people's throat, and thereby, of course, to loop back to our concept, build social trust.
Yeah, it needs to start somewhere.
Yeah, sure.
You can't order trust. You need to build it up. And that also means to sometimes make the first step.
Okay, this reminds me a lot of what Popper writes about the strain of civilization. You know, like a lot of being part of the open society takes a lot of effort. And what you describe with your practices is something that is a constant reminder that it takes us to take a step back. But that's a very hard task to do. But I mean, as we are just at the beginning of this project to revive liberalism, I think it is worthwhile to look into these spiritual practices. And I hope we find some better terminology than the Rawlsian one of the wheel of ignorance or reflective equilibrium. These are very, as you described them, technocratic terms. But I want to close on one thing, and that is a book recommendation. So usually we ask our guests what kind of book they really would recommend liberals to read and that they haven't read yet. Of course, your book goes first in that recommendation list. I really recommend our listeners to pick up a copy of Liberalism as a Way of Life and take it from there, obviously. But Alex, what kind of other books would you recommend to our listeners?
If I can go two for one, I'll recommend a classic and a contemporary. So the classic book I would suggest is Judith Schlar. Judith Schlar's book in particular, Ordinary Vices. So John Rawls was, as it were, the king of philosophy, and he was at Harvard. Well, the queen of philosophy was at Harvard, at political philosophy was at Harvard, and her name was Judith Schlar. And late in her life in 1985, she published a book called Ordinary Vices, which is about trying to recover what a liberal sensibility would look like. And she roots it back all the way back to a beautiful author, Michel de Montaigne, but also Montesquieu. And what she talks about is how a liberal sensibility really takes its root in when we start to think of harm and of evil and of sin, not in terms of how we offend against God, but how we offend against each other. And so what it does is it transforms morality from this vertical kind of relationship between you and another kind of plane of existence of God into one that is, let's say, mundane or temporal or secular, that is between the harms and the goodnesses and the kindnesses that you and I do to each other. And it starts small. It starts with two weird French noblemen from the city of Bordeaux, but in a few hundred years, it will take over the Western world. And she traces out where that sensibility starts and where it goes. I love that book. The other book I would recommend is an author I mentioned earlier, is Samuel Moyn, and he wrote a book last year called Liberalism Against Itself. It's a book I really like because Moyn is often seen as a progressive lefty critic of liberalism, and I think he is in important respects, but he's also trying to recover its revolutionary potential. And what he talks about in that book is trying to suggest how liberalism can be, as it were, made great again by recovering two impulses that it lost along the way. One is its progressivism and its notion of welfare and justice, and the other is its perfectionism in the sense of what it means to live a good life. He thought that liberals had a sense of what that meant in the 19th century, but along the way in the 20th, it lost its mojo, and it's up to us to recover now. And if my book makes a small contribution in that direction, then I'm a happy author.
And I might just add to that list a book that is very much in the vein of your own book, and that is Russ Roberts' How Adam Smith Can Change Your Life. So it has a self-help dimension to it, and he talks about the moral sentiments of Adam Smith. So usually we have two Adam Smiths, the one of the Wealth of Nations and the other ones of the moral sentiments. And Russ Roberts tried to combine the two with a more distinct perspective on the moral sentiments and the moral qualities of an individual and what Adam Smith can add to that contribution. And he argues that at the heart of Adam Smith, it is not that we are loved, but that we are lovely as liberals. Yes. And I think that's very much adding to the conversation that we just had. So thank you, Alex, for joining us today from the other part of the world. We very much enjoyed not only this conversation, but also your book. So keep up the good work, and hopefully we will be talking in the future, because your project is very important. And for all of our listeners, thank you very much for joining in, and make sure to subscribe to our podcast and then listen in to further continued conversations. Thank you very much.